Okay, I'm going to ask you to take a mental leap back to the time when I am 15 years old. So I'll let you adjust. Now you get to know that this is kind of the middle of the 20th century. Your minister was about 2 years old, I think, at this time. You got to get yourself there. I'm out to lunch with my mother and my grandmother, and I get up to go to the bathroom, walk right in to the men's room. This is the 20th century. You don't have like men and women on this time of day and children on this time of day. It's like men, women, very gender binary. I walked right into the men's room and no men were in there. It was an empty room, so it wasn't very awkward. So I'm 15, right? I walk in, I see this line of urinals and I say, huh, this must have been a men's room once. Go right into the stall, sit down. I'm having a seat. I hear the door open and footsteps come in. Go right into the stall next to me. So what do? Ladies, you look under the... And I'm like, it's a man's shoes and a man's pants. And oh my God, there's a pervert in the bathroom. But then I start to kind of rewind the tape, you know? And I'm like thinking urinals. And I'm like, I'm the pervert in the bathroom. What am I gonna do? Well, of course, the guy, he gets done, washes his hands, I hope, and he leaves. And I'm thinking, I just gotta get out of here as fast as I can, and maybe nobody will notice. And I think I would have made it too, except that my mother and my grandmother been sitting in that restaurant, and they saw me go into the men's room, and they're like, she's not coming out of there. See a guy go in there, stay in there also. And then finally, of course, after he comes out, they see me come out. They burst into hysterical laughter, and I'm standing there. I'm framed in the men's room door. Yeah, 15. It was mortifying. So Catherine Schultz is a self-described wrongologist. She's actually a scientist, and she's written a book, and she's given a great big TED talk. You may have even seen it. Catherine Schultz, though, calls herself a wrongologist because she studies the phenomenon of being wrong. What is it like to be wrong? So she's given her TED talk, and you know those TED talk audiences aren't just people in off the street, right? These are invited people. So she looks at one of the guys in the first row, and she says, "Hey there, Mr. CFO, astrophysicist ultra marathoner." And then she looks around the room and says, "Wait, you're all CFO astrophysicist ultra marathoners here. These are people who are used to being right." So she asks them, "How does it feel to be wrong?" So I ask you, how does it feel to be wrong? Not so good. These people say, "Oh, it feels terrible. It's embarrassing." That's what the TED Talk audience comes up with, probably some similar things to what you've come up with. And Catherine Schultz says these are wonderful answers to an entirely different question. You've been answering the question, how does it feel to realize you're wrong? Teenage girl standing framed in a men's room door. Oh, so wrong. Embarrassing. But just being wrong, you know what the trouble is? Being wrong feels just like being right. It really does. Makes me think about that time, you know, it must have been a men's room once. Look at all these urinals in here. Schultz says when Wile E. Coyote runs off a cliff, he keeps running in a straight line. He doesn't even know he's in danger. And there comes that moment when he looks down and then he kind of looks at the camera, the audience. And only then does he fall. Only then does he have that feeling, uh-oh, I'm wrong. So that dreadful, embarrassing, difficult, awkward part is really the moment of recognition that you're feeling, recognizing I'm wrong. Imagine this. A surgeon is doing a post-op visit, and the patient looks down at herself, and she looks at the doctor and she says, "Doctor, why are all these bandages on the wrong side of my body?" Wow, what a sick feeling, huh? Any doctors in the room? Surgeons? That would be wretched. And the thing is, this exact incident happened at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. That's one of the top hospitals in the world. And the hospital released a statement about it, and I quote, "For whatever reason, the surgeon simply felt that he was on the correct side of the patient." At least he didn't insist that he had been right. That was the right kidney. Well, you know, there's a Facebook page called Realizing You're Wrong in the Middle of the Argument and Continuing to Argue. It has 1.5 million followers, including me, because at least I know I'm not alone. But of course I'm not alone. It's a human thing. Everybody makes mistakes. Being right is just so much more satisfying, whether it's being right about the age of the universe or the outcome of the Super Bowl. We all love being right. I do. Catherine Schultz says our wholly indiscriminate enjoyment of being right is matched by an almost equally indiscriminate feeling that we are right. And we know better. We know we can't any of us be right all the time. Yet Schultz says of all the conflict in the world, from spouses arguing about whether she asked him to buy a crumb cake or a pound cake, to conflict in the Middle East, a staggering amount of it arises from the clash of mutually incompatible, entirely unshakable feelings of rightness. Now, you don't have to go as far as the Middle East to see this played out. American society is polarized today. You don't have to go far at all. You can see it at your dinner table, perhaps, or at least in your families, extended families, sometimes in your congregations, in your community. It plays out around us constantly. We're living in, well, the technical term for it is a hot mess. You know, that's the kind of church acceptable descriptive term about what times we're living in. This polarization, this unshakable sense that one side is right, no, the other side is right, that's eroding our civil life and our ability to have discourse. And in the middle of that clash of entirely unshakable feelings of rightness, it's practically irresistible to take a side, right? Stand your ground. You know you're right. Am I right? I mean, you know. Social psychologist Jonathan Haidt and his teams went around the world and they researched morals and ethics and values. They also specifically looked across the spectrum in the United States. You probably heard about the results of his team. It's gotten a lot of press. He established 5 moral foundations everyone shares: compassion, fairness, loyalty, order, and purity. Yeah, see, there's always that little chuckle when you say purity in a room full of liberals. But what if you don't think about sex and you think about your food, Mr. GMO vegan ultramarathoner? Purity, there it is. So compassion, fairness, loyalty, order, and purity. Across cultures, these are universal values. It's just that people disagree on how to order them, which ones are most important. Liberals usually put compassion and fairness on top. We rank them above values like group loyalty, above values like social order, even purity, unless we're in Trader Joe's. Conservatives value compassion and fairness too, but their list is topped by social order and loyalty and purity. Haidt says morality is so essential to our species survival that we're born with a kind of first draft morality coded into the system, and then those 5 foundational values grow. We learn to experience the world in different ways, and we start to order them. You can eventually find people clustering together with matching ordering schemes of these basic values, and you can predict some little clusters in their characteristic. Imagine, say, an artist and an accountant. You can probably predict which one is likely to eat at a neighborhood bistro whose menu is based on seasonal and local options, and which one is more likely to eat at Applebee's, whose menu is the same from city to city, its tastes and its prices predictable. Social order, loyalty, Yeah, once you understand the difference, Hyde says, you can understand why somebody would eat at Applebee's, just not anyone you know. Well, there are lots of ways we can cluster predictability. People who value an open, changing society tend to fall on the liberal and progressive side. We'll put them on the left over here. People who value more homogeneity, more purity, tend to be conservatives. Sorry if you're sitting on the right over here. These rankings show up in surprising ways. If liberals get a dog, they want it to be independent-minded, who relates to its owner as a friend and an equal, right? Yeah. Conservatives look for a dog who is loyal to its home and family and doesn't warm up quickly to strangers. Liberals think, is that dog running for the Republican nomination or what? So as a first draft of morality, we revise it over time and experience, and Haidt says this is the way we construct the moral matrix. And in that matrix, we view the world. Now, have you seen the movie The Matrix? I hope so. That's a fantastic movie. If you haven't, that's your homework for this afternoon. It's chilly. You go stream that movie. In the movie, people are trapped in a computer-generated view of reality, and they get a choice during the movie of whether they want to wake up to real reality or stay in this computer-generated illusion. And the twist in the movie is that that turns out to be a really difficult choice for people. Maybe it's better to stay in the illusion and the little bubble. Do we care if we're wrong as long as we get to feel right? It's hard to say. Catherine Schultz says it's as if we think our minds are perfect windows on reality, and we just sit and gaze out of them and watch things unfold, and we want everyone to gaze out the exact same window and see the exact same thing. So if you're gazing out your moral matrix window, you're comfortable, you know in your bones that you are right, and surprisingly, you encounter some other people that disagree with you. So what do? Catherine Schultz says the first thing you do is you assume they're just ignorant. They do not have all the facts, and if they only had all the information, they would clearly see things the way you do. Here, let me explain it to you. Liberals are usually really patient explainers. You know, for the good of society, shouldn't there be gun control? I mean, really. But say your conservative brother-in-law is not convinced by your patient explanation. He has all the right information, thanks to you, and nevertheless, he persists. Schultz says, here's where we go next. He might be stupid. Just maybe somewhat intellectually inferior, just a little bit. Remember how Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama both got caught on tape when they didn't know they were being taped, talking about those people who hold their guns close and their Bibles even closer? Remember those kind of comments? Yeah, that made liberals a lot of friends, didn't it? Mm-hmm. Convinced lots of other people about the rightness of our position. What a way to share. I live in a red state, and bumper stickers started appearing on great big old pickup trucks. It said, proud deplorable. Yeah. When you think about it, that's a pretty fair reaction for someone who's just heard that they are kind of stupid. So what happens? Okay, we discover that these people have all the information that we do, and then in fact, they are not really very stupid at all. Some of them have PhDs from Harvard. They were Rhodes Scholars. We discover these things, and Catherine Schultz says, okay, they're not ignorant, they're not stupid. They must be evil. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to demonize other people. And what a neat trick, because once somebody's evil, there's no sense talking with them anymore, and you sure don't need to listen to them. Jonathan Haidt says, if you believe that half of America votes Republican because they are either stupid or blinded by religion or just plain evil, then you are trapped in a moral matrix. And just like in that movie, The Matrix, we're offered a choice. We can stay in that comfortable bubble of rightness, or we can be open to the reality that there is moral diversity in the world. Haidt says, if our goal is to understand the world, then a general lack of moral diversity is going to make it harder, because when people all share morals, all share values, they become a team, like a tribe, like a congregation. Whatever you call your team, the psychology of teams shuts down open-minded thinking. So you remember that question, how does it feel to be wrong? And you remember the answer, it feels just the same as it does to be right. My internal sense of rightness is not a reliable guide to external reality. I know that being right all the time about everything is humanly impossible. My husband will be here later. I'll deny I ever said that. I'm one of the people who calls myself a humanist, and so I like to embrace our full humanity, and that includes accepting our fallibility. Cogito ergo sum, Descartes said in 1637. That's pretty ancient philosophical stuff. I think, therefore I am. But around the year 400, Augustine said, si fallor sum, if I am mistaken, then I am. I'm wrong. There's something about being wrong that's just part of the hardwired system. When it comes right down to it, I think the most tragic thing about insisting on being right and holding on to that is that we miss out so much. We miss out on opportunities to really have dialogues with people that aren't just like us. We miss out for some kind of human connection. We miss out on learning some things because we have become so convinced that we know it already. We miss out on a fresh perspective. I think that's really how human creativity works, if it comes right down to it. That's how human reason works. When we reason together, not just with people who agree with us, but people who have profoundly different ideas, maybe just who prioritize those values in a different way, loyalty, honor, order, safety. What window is that? What might I see if I looked out that? I mean, aren't you a little bit interested in hearing from a gun rights advocate about why they feel so fierce about defending the Second Amendment? I mean, don't tell me it's because they're stupid or ignorant or evil, because you're talking about my nephew, who proudly served in the United States Marines. He currently teaches concealed carry classes in his home state of Missouri. One of those deplorables, maybe? I'll tell you, he would put his life at risk for any one of ours. He's fiercely loyal, he's brave, and he is not stupid. I have to assume that other Americans who lift up the right to bear arms are complex and interesting people too, and that about some things, they're even right. Catherine Schultz says, if you really want to rediscover wonder, you need to step outside that tiny, terrified space of rightness. Look out at the mystery of the universe and say, wow, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Remember that surgeon who felt like he was on the correct side? The reason we know the story is that Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center publicly told that story. They admitted the mistake in hopes that it would lead to better hospital protocols. And it has done that. It has resulted in more hospitals around the world getting it right. As tempting as it is to be right about everything all the time, it's a very heavy burden to bear. And if you carry that around, it weighs you around like Wile E. Coyote with an anvil tied on his ankle. Being able to just let go of that burden of rightness and righteousness is a revelatory experience. Our human experience becomes so much fuller and truer when we learn to admit fallibility, limits, and when we learn to forgive ourselves and each other for being wrong. I don't know, my friends, that kind of feels a lot like being right.